from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In his new collection of essays, What Light Can Do, Robert Haas offers insights, ruminations, and meditations on a diverse range of subjects. The former poet laureate draws on his vast literary knowledge in essays that examine artistic works, the relationship between literature and religion, and the backstory of a UC Berkeley protest. He'll join us to discuss his essays and career. He won the 2008 Pulitzer Prize for Poetry and is a professor of poetry and poetics at UC Berkeley. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this hour of our forum program. Robert Haas joins us in studio for this forum hour, the San Francisco native, a recipient of the National Book Award, National Book Critics Circle Award, and the Pulitzer Prize, served as Poet Laureate of the United States from 1995 to 1997, and is Chancellor of the Academy of American Poets. His books on poetry include Apple Trees at Olema, Time and Materials, Sun Under Wood, Human Wishes, and Praise and Field Guide, and he has translated a number of the poetry volumes of Nobel laureates, Czesław Miłosz and Tomasz Transtorm, as well as many others. And he is also the author of a collection of essays, 20th Century Pleasures, Prose on Poetry, which was published back in 1984. And recently published a new volume of essays, What Light Can Do, Essays on Art, Imagination, and the Natural World. Robert Haas is professor of poetry and poetics at UC Berkeley and joins us in studio for this forum hour. So good to have you back here. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure.
Well, I was almost tempted to begin by hearing your Occupied story, but let me tease that. We'll go into the book first because, I was reading the emails at the time and they were fast and furious coming from people about what you and Brenda Hillman, your wife, also a famed poet, went through. Let's talk first about this book, though, because these are essays, and everybody associates Bob Haas with poetry, but these are wonderful essays, and I enjoyed them immensely. And you say essays are like a photo. They're an inquiry, they're a search, tension, concentration on a subject. And that, in some ways, might strike one as almost antithetical to what poetry is. But essays can be, of course, and are. Yours are very poetic. Poetry involves an entirely different transportation, one thinks, of the imagination.
It does for me. I think that I find it very hard to do both at the same time because you're thinking in different rhythms when you're doing them. And I find I love and hate the essay form because of its requirement. Both its requirement, that is, you start the damn thing and you have to finish it. And also, you don't quite know where you're going. And poems have their way of telling you what they are and where they're going, in my experience.
Guiding you?
Yeah. And in essay, it's, you know, you're climbing the cliff barehanded.
You also write one of your essays about poems being spiritual, and essays don't strike one as necessarily spiritual, but I suppose they can be too, can't they?
Oh, sure. I think about what would be a quick example. I mean, there are different kinds of spirituality. If you took, say, Montaigne and Erasmus to be, not that I've read them recently, but think of this spirit of sane, rational, humanistic inquiry as itself a spiritual activity, then they certainly are.
But I don't know, do you get imaginary gardens with real toads in them, like Marianne Moore said about poetry?
I guess you can. The essayist that whom I read and fell in love with when I was a college student that made me fall in love with the essay was James Baldwin. Mm. And those early books of his
like The Fire
essays,
Next Time. And,
yeah,
you
well,
know,
before
Notes of
that,
a Native Son.
Notes of a Native Son, Nobody Knows My Name. Those essays were so gorgeous and such a revelation. This would have been for late 50s, early 60s, early days of the civil rights movement, and these just luminous, magical pieces of writing about what it was like to live inside his skin, black man's skin, in America and Europe in those years were so gorgeous.
And I also love those Baldwin essays. I'm wondering, though, about – I remember interviewing Cynthia Ozick, and she said the difference between writing an essay and writing, say, a work of fiction – I'm thinking about, say, something like Sonny's Blues or Giovanni's Room, yeah, or Go Tell It on the Mountain – is that you're – it's not only that your imagination is moving in an entirely different realm, but when you put the essay down, those ideas are subject to change.
Yes, that's true. It's true. I mean, that's the other part, and that's the other reason why it's freehold claiming, is that it's more arbitrary. You can do it this way, you can do it that way. With poetry, the life of a poet consists of second thoughts in a way. One poem generates another. In an essay, you're kind of supposed to get it for now on this subject.
I'm reminded of a line of Baldwin's actually in the story Sonny's Blues when he says, the narrator, about music. He's talking about the blues, really, and the music that goes all the way back to the spirituals. He says, this is all the light we have in this darkness, yeah, meaning what brings us forward and human connection and all that art provides for us. And I'm struck by your title here, What Light Can Do.
Yeah.
Well, why that title? Because you've got a whole range of essays here.
Well,
so you're illuminating, right?
I mean, partly because there were essays about photography. There are four or five essays about photographers and photography in the book. So, and I use that phrase in one of those essays, that photographers like painters tell us what light can do. I was hesitant to use it as a title because it seemed like I was claiming to be able to illuminate subjects, but you try.
But that you do illuminate subjects. I mean, there's art, there's nature, there's the human condition. I mean, it's all here in this wonderful anthology of yours.
Well, thank you. One hopes.
One hopes. Let's talk about some of the writers, actually, that you write about, like Chekhov. You know, we all think of Chekhov as such a compassionate, loving, decent human being, you know, working with the poor as the good doctor and all that. Yeah. You get to that kind of flinty, mean side of him.
Yeah, I loved writing. I loved the reading of Chekhov in that way. And someone asked me if I would give a lecture on a writer I loved, not a poet. And I thought of Chekhov immediately. And then for summer, and I recommend this to listeners, I started with the first story Chekhov got published in a serious literary journal in 1883. And I read all through the stories. And you can do it in the eight volumes of the Oxford Chekhov is one way, but there are other ways. And it's just so extraordinary, the work. And when I was through with it, I wanted to talk about what a tough guy he was. And I discovered in the course of reading about him that, in fact, he started his life as a writer writing jokes for comic magazines in Moscow in the early 1880s to support his family. He and his brothers were, like the young Woody Allen in Brooklyn, was feeding gags to the magazines, and they paid more for shorter pieces than they did for longer pieces. And so he had to learn to do these pithy things, and he wrote them under a pseudonym. And at the kitchen table in this tenement in Moscow, where his father had gone broke running a grocery store in the south in Taganrog, in a port city in the Black Sea, father was kind of a bully, an awful man, but he moved the whole family, the Chekhov girls, the two other brothers, into this tenement in Moscow and left Anton to finish high school in down near the Ukraine. He came, saw what dire straits they were in, and he started writing jokes to support the family. And within a year, he goes to St. Petersburg from Moscow. He writes to his brother and said, "Guess what? I'm all the thing." Everyone was reading his funny
short
stories.
You see that tough humor in him, and it's really there. It's
there.
Not only there in the stories; it's there in the plays too.
Yeah, and well, because you know, he knew what the world was like. Everyone was writing these ideological stories about noble peasants, and he was a peasant. And then as a doctor, he treated the peasants, so he knew what was going on. Some of the early stories of things like a bunch of sailors are all casting lots to see who gets to look through the porthole where the young minister and his wife are going to consummate their marriage. There's a father and a son among the sailors, and the son wins. And the father, and so they're both looking in through the porthole, and they see the bride looking down and demurely saying no to something, and the husband pleading, and the wife demurely saying no, and finally she makes a gesture of relenting, and the door opens, and a banker comes in and hands the minister rubles and walks out, and the father sailor says, the son sailor says, you can't watch this, son. There's some things you're too young to see. So they're funny, dark, cynical, short, jokey stories. And out of that spun this amazing, amazing body of work.
Yeah. Well, in fact, you know, Nabokov said that the lady with the dog, or the lady with the lap dog, is the greatest story ever written.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, that sounds pretty hyperbolic to my ears, but it could be one of the greatest stories ever
written. Oh, God, it's so wonderful, isn't it?
And yet, the humor is there, too. Uh-huh. I mean, in so much of the, particularly, as you point out, the early work. I mean, you have a different take on many of these writers, which was one of the things that I found fascinating. And there's a whole section I should mention in Robert Hasse's collection, What Light Can Do, of essays on California writers, on Jack London, on Mary Austin, on William Everson, the good brother. But there's also an essay on Maxine Hong Kingston that I was struck by, because little did I think of Maxine Hong Kingston as, or Woman Warrior, particularly with No Name Woman as the opening section, as a success story. But in many ways, you're right. It is a kind of success story. I mean, when you think about the main character, Little Dog, and where she takes us with her. And you also try to account for the popularity of it. And in many ways, it may have had to do with the timing, I thought. You know, it was a feminist book. It was interest in ethnic writers and all of that. But the whole idea of a success story was really quite new to me.
Yes, it's true that in one way it is. And it's also, I was saying, one of the reasons, occasions for writing it was I just read that this would have been in the early 90s, that Woman Warrior was the most widely taught text in American colleges and universities, that it had become the entry-level book. And I thought, well, maybe there's something wrong with it after all, and read it again. And it's, you know, it's just a great story. And reading, picking it up, I read the first sentence, which I'm quoting from memory, the first sentence of Woman Warrior is, "And now, my mother said, I am going to tell you something that you must tell to no one." So it enacts the writer's first act of betrayal and self-invention in the very first sentence.
And arouses the reader's wonder as to what is this great secret, which, of course, the mother is imparting to the daughter as she comes in to have her first period. Don't shame us the way your aunt did, who no longer exists even in name or memory.
Right. You know? I mean, in one way or another, we all wrest our identities from family secrets. So it wonderfully announces a kind of archetypal journey.
It's a buildings roman, like you said, but it also seems to suggest, and by the way, when we did features on California writers, we had Woman Warriors, one of the books, and Maxine actually called in during the program. So Maxine, if you're listening, feel free to join us. But there's the sense you have that she kind of shifts a lot of the blame in terms of the politics to China. And there's a lot of blame with America as well.
Yeah, well,
blame for women and the way they're treated, which in China, of course, is appalling, the way she presents it. But still, there's American...
At the time, Woman Warrior and the success of Woman Warrior made some male Chinese-American writers very angry. And it made them angry because they thought...
Particularly someone named Frank Chin.
Frank Chin was among them, a playwright. And he felt that she was flattering European-American audiences by putting down Chinese-American males. And I think she responded to that partly by writing the next book, China Men, which is not as often read, but I think in some ways it's certainly an equally brilliant book to talk about what happened to Chinese immigrant men in America, particularly in the Bay Area. But actually, the book reaches to New York. It's very inventive. Very inventive book of it's a genre history writing of that kind. It's hard to know what compare it to. William Carlos Williams in The American Grain, John Dos Passos USA, few handful of really wonderful books that put history and personal life together and make literature.
You talk about literature in general as well, you speak about, and I should mention the first essay is all about Wallace Stevens, but there are essays in here about Mishima. I mean, the range about Ernesto Catterall, a Nicaraguan poet, the range of your reading is in itself humbling and somewhat extraordinary. But you talk about a sense of literature as being causing resistance. It seems like, and maybe I was wrong about this, literature is restrains us against force, in a whole essay, in fact, about war. But when you're writing about Milos, whom I know you not only translated but knew very well, and there are two wonderful essays in here about Milos, you talk about the central scene where he was pinned down on the ground, became a central scene for Eastern Europe and Central Europe. German gunfire and strafing and all that. And he didn't want that to be politicized. I mean, too often literature is politicized.
Yeah.
And I guess when you were talking about Kingston, I was thinking about how she too had her work politicized.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's true. Chekhov's attitude toward that piece of writing and the way that by writing such an electrifying the image comes from a book called The Captive Mind, and it describes him in Warsaw, I think in Warsaw, at curfew, a whistle blows, he hits the ground, machine gun strafing a cobblestone street in front of him and turning up the cobblestones like the quills on a porcupine turning up. And he has in his back pocket the poems of T.S. Eliot. And he has them there partly because he was thinking, if the Russians win the war, the Poles are done for. If the Germans win the war, the Poles are done for. Maybe the English and the Americans somehow are a way out. And he started learning English. They already knew four or five languages. So he has a copy of Eliot's The Wasteland in his back pocket, which for that generation was a book of aesthetic despair. And he's thinking, The Wasteland is just not going to do it. And that image made the book famous. And another writer of that period, Gombrowicz, said, Milos, with one image, shifted the center of European culture from Paris to Eastern Europe in the middle of the war. At a babe, Chekhov, he was saying. And Milos later came to regret that because he felt like, on a number of counts, I think, one was, Poles lived from September 1939 to the end of the war when Warsaw was leveled to the ground by German demolition teams, street by street. People had toothaches, love affairs. That the image of the resistance as one long gesture of heroic existential assertion of moral good in this evil time was not what it was like. And it pained him to be seen that way. He didn't think it was the truth. That's number one. Number two, he thought in some way that the awfulness of that war was only an intensification of other kinds of awfulness, that poets have to write about the world as given. And that his being seen only as a hero of the resistance in World War II, when in fact he was not a resistance in the resistance army himself. He disapproved of it, in fact.
Disapproved of it, why?
I'm putting words in his mouth now, and if people want to track this, there are three books. There's The Captive Mind, a novel that he wrote immediately after the war called State of Siege, which is about what was going on inside the Home Army in Poland during that time. And the third book is Native Realm, is a kind of intellectual autobiography. There were days when the symbolic battle would be over something like whether Copernicus was Polish or German. So Poles, at the beginning of the German occupation, went out and started putting Polish flags on the statue of Copernicus, because one of the cultural things that the Germans did to take away the cultural status from the Poles is say, well, Copernicus, who was their only real scientist, was really a German. So the Poles would go out, young Polish guys would go out and put a flag up on the statue, and if they were seen doing it, they'd be shot. And Miloš thought it was completely crazy. He thought that the war was going to play out.
That the resistance would go to those kind of extremes.
Yeah, he says later, you mistook lyrical beauty for physical force. Mm-hmm. And so he just thought it was at the core of the Polish resistance movement was this endless suicidal romantic Polish romanticism and resistance that had been going on since Chopin and before, and that people needed to be craftier than that. And he blamed a lot of the Polish writers for the deaths of – he was in his late 30s in those years. He was born in 1911. He blamed – Polish writers for reading in the underground these heroic stories to teenagers and young adult Polish writers, and they'd go out and get themselves killed.
Talking to Robert Haas, his new collection of essays is out. It's called What Light Can Do, Essays on Art, Imagination, and the Natural World. And we invite your involvement in this conversation. In fact, if you'd like to join us, you can do that now. Our toll-free number is available to you, and we will get to the occupied adventure and ordeal that I mentioned at the top of the hour. But feel free to join us in conversation. In fact, we welcome your calls, and you can talk with Bob Haas and join us now. It's toll-free. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. 866-733-6786, former Poet Laureate of the United States, here with us in studio for the hour. You can also email us, and we do welcome your communication by email as well, forum@kqed.org, or post questions or comments on our website simply by going to kqed.org/forum, click on the segment, or you can tweet us at @forumkqed. Is another way, of course, to communicate with us your ideas and your thoughts, talking about a whole range of things in this conversation. But as always with Robert Haas, we talk about poetry, and we talk about poetry as opposed to the essay form or essay form as opposed to poetry. And some of you who are practitioners or aficionados or simply appreciators may want to talk about some of the differences and distinctions as we've been talking about it, or just talk about some of the writers we've been talking about. And as I said, he covers a whole range of writers and thinkers in this new book of his. When we return, we'll hear from you, and we'll hear about the occupied adventure. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Robert Haas, winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry in 2008, former Poet Laureate of the United States, and professor of poetry and poetics at UC Berkeley. He's published a new collection of essays called What Light Can Do, and offers us insights, ruminations, and meditations. In fact, one of his most famous poems is called Meditation Mendocino, on a diverse range of subjects, drawing on really a vast literary knowledge in essays that examine artistic works and the relationship between literature and religion, and the backstory of a UC Berkeley protest, which I hope maybe we can get to also in the course of this hour. I mentioned the occupied adventure, though. I want to get to that. You can join us, let me add that, Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you have for Robert Haas on our website, kqed.org/forum, or go to our Facebook page. And I just also thinking about your essay here on Howell. I was talking about with Bob Haas when we were off the air about the fact that he kind of suggested maybe 1010 Montgomery Street here in San Francisco ought to be have a literary monument. I was struck by what you talked about as the autobiographical elements of Howell and the source of Moloch in it and all the really good literary analysis you do. And I couldn't help just asking you about my own sense of that poem as it is retained in my imagination as being such a revolutionary poem in many ways. It was the shock of the poem. I mean, there's a lot of shocking things in that poem, really, you know, when you really kind of catalog it, to use a good Whitman word, yeah?
Yeah, there was. I mean, and I think there was intended to be a lot of shock. And later, as an older man talking about it, he would say, I was shocking myself. I was thinking, what would my father think as he was writing out in these long jazz-like rhythms, these hyperbolic descriptions of all of his desperado friends from the Upper West Side. And
also, as you point out, writing about Carl Solomon. I mean, Carl Solomon tends to dominate at the end of Howl, so it is autobiographical in that sense. And he becomes almost, as you point out, emblematic of Ginsberg's mother, who was mad, and madness that Ginsberg felt in himself.
Yeah, I think he talked about vomiting his paranoia at some point. And I thought one of the autobiographical roots of the poem and of the story of its coming into existence was that his mother went crazy. She became paranoid and delusional, and she was committed to a mental institution. And when he was a kid, his father was a poet, mild, sweet school teacher. Louis Ginsberg. Yeah. His poems are in the public library, if you're curious.
They used to read together. They read together at San Francisco State, way back when. Yeah.
And Alan was sent by his father to the institution where his mother was to sign the papers to permit her lobotomy. This was right around, not long after, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were electrocuted for treason for passing on nuclear secrets to the Soviet Union. His mother had been, as if she were a Southern Baptist, she was a Jewish communist girl in 1927 or 28 and went off to summer camps where, I don't know what you did calisthenics and looked at portraits of Lenin plus...
Well, a lot of it was also Stalinist in those days, too, probably.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, there's this enormous reservoir of anger, guilt, shame in him, connected also, I'm sure, to his discovery of his sexuality in those years, and it exploded into this poem once he got to San Francisco.
Bring a couple of callers in here, and then I will go to the two stories I want to hear from you that are sort of, well, one is in the new collection, and one is the Grove of Oaks to accomplish building an athletic facility. Many people remember at UC Berkeley, which Bob writes about in his new collection, but also when the Occupy movement went on, he was, as Whitman said, he was the man. I'm paraphrasing. He was there. So let's hear some of your calls, though. We'll go first to Ping, who's joining us from Berkeley. Hi.
Hi. I have a friend who is a professional poet, and I once mentioned to him that I really enjoyed the work of Billy Collins. And I was shocked by his response, which was that he felt Billy Collins wasn't actually poetry. And I asked him to explain that. He said he didn't mean it in a disparaging way, but he just felt that it didn't fall in that category for him. And I'm curious.
What did he think Billy Collins was, if not a poet?
Not that. I guess he didn't say that Billy Collins wasn't a poet, but he said that the works I liked, which I considered poems, I guess they didn't fall in the category of poetry because they were too much like prose, or they didn't technically seem like they fit that category for him. I don't know if either of you have ever heard that, or. You had any thoughts about it?
Who said that?
A friend of his said about Billy Collins, that Billy Collins wasn't, I guess, really a real poet, that maybe it was too much prose poetry or not.
Yeah,
you hear this.
That's a funny set of categories, what constitutes real poetry. He writes verse, and he's a poet.
I think that would be my response, too. Thank you for the call. You tell your friend. Here's Chris from Berkeley. Hi, Chris.
Yes, hi, Michael. Thanks for taking my call. Great show. I'm a social scientist, and I was delighted to hear Mr. Hoff talk about Maxine Hong Kingston, saying that she brings together the historical and the personal, because that immediately reminded me of C. Wright Mills, a great American sociologist and social critic, who said exactly the same thing about sociology. In fact, he said, that's the goal of sociology, is to make the personal historical and vice versa. And I wondered if Mr. Haas had a comment about that.
Well, it's one of the jobs of literature, isn't it, always, of writing, to connect the large movements of life that we seem to be swept along by with the texture of actual lives, from War and Peace to Woman Warrior.
And I thank you for the call. There's also a wonderful essay in your collection about war that features an essay by Kant and the whole idea of perpetual peace. And again, I guess I'm just flogging the book here because there's just so much in it that's rich. And yet I promise I've been teasing long enough about this Occupied story. So let's let's get to it. Just one quick web comment. Much love to Professor Haas. I had him when I was an undergraduate at UC Berkeley, where he co-taught an environment science class, providing a literary and poetic view of nature. Lovely and inspiring, like his poetry.
Well, thank you.
Good to hear. All right, so the Occupied story. You and Brenda are there, and
we were actually at Occupy Oakland, going to see what was going on. In my case, going to see what was going on. In Brenda's case, to be there and participate. And I had been told in the afternoon, or heard in the early evening, that in the afternoon, the police, campus police, had brutally, the quotation was, brutally beaten students in front of Sproul Hall. And I didn't believe it. I thought it was hyperbole. And in the evening, we got a tweet from friends saying the police and the Alameda County deputy sheriffs have just moved back into Sproul Plaza in force, and there looks like there's going to be trouble. And I thought, well, this time I want to see what happens. So we drove back to Berkeley, and around 8:30, I guess, in the evening, and I shouldered my way. It was a cool November night, kids with frosty breath, and I shouldered my way to the front of the crowd because I wanted to see what was going on, and I didn't really quite understand that I was putting myself in the front line just at the moment when the Alameda County Sheriff's officers and the campus police were going to move into the crowd with billy clubs and whack them until they moved out of the way so that they could take down these symbolic tents that the students had put up. So we were standing in the front of the line, this cordon of young deputy sheriffs was forming. I thought they looked terrified. They were trying to stand there and look brave and scary and not meet anybody's eyes. Young guys, mostly. There was one woman among in the group of them. And then at a certain moment, my wife, who always has kind things to say and things to say, was explaining to them why they would have been better being home reading to their children. One of them reached out and pushed her in the chest and knocked her down. And she bounced back up, but I moved around to trying to do the courtly thing and pick her up, and fell over and got up and started yelling at what the hell. And at that moment, the order was given to push back the crowd. So we're in the front. There's several hundred students pushing against us. So there was no way we could go anywhere anyway. And the young cops, Alameda deputy sheriffs, just started wailing at the ribs of everybody in front of them with these black, the newspapers all call them batons.
And sometimes they say truncheon or billy club.
It's a funny word. Well, they say baton, and if you want to buy one online.
Conductors like the symphony, right?
To put it in the hands of university administrators so they could feel what it felt like. They're called batons, like so, either relays or symphony, or but anyway, they're about the size of a little league baseball bat, and they were jamming them into the ribs of the kids. A couple of the young policemen used them as bars to just push people, but they drove everyone back, and I was standing right there, so I got whacked in the ribs and over the arms with the billy club a couple of times, and then the order came. And then they stopped, and then they did it once again. And at a certain point, they'd gotten the tents down, and they stopped doing it. But the shock of it, of being not wasn't so much being hit myself, which shocked me, but watching these young guys just wailing on my students, co-eds, guys. It's probably sexist in my generation, but I thought, oh my God, they're hitting the women in the same way they're hitting the men. If people turn to escape it, they hit them in the side and the ribs. If they turn to the back, they're hitting them in the back, which is really scary because spinal injury could happen. Though, no, as far as I know, no serious serious debilitating injuries happened. People were, I couldn't go to the gym for 3 days because my stomach was sore. But and I thought in afterwards that the young man who pushed my wife down probably had gotten the order to advance and didn't want to hit this older woman, and so he pushed her instead. Perhaps that was true. And in fact, it spoke to some training on their part that they used what they thought was minimum force. So it was a shocking amount of force, and people had ribs broken. And
so you were shocked. I mean, the key word here is you didn't expect this. And what did you come away with from it in terms of what you were able to process or deduce?
I came away thinking that my students got the first lesson about politics, that power in the end comes from the barrel of a pistol or the end of a billy club. That's what they would learn, and it's not. Maybe that's an interesting lesson for people to learn at one of the great universities of the world. You'd hope that they learn another lesson, that there would have been another way to deal with what was really a symbolic act.
Remember,
they
used to put flowers in the rifles during the 60s.
I do that. Were you there, Michael?
I was there.
I was there too. And in fact, a lot of those chants came back. The kids around me were chanting at the cops, "You're big, you're cute, take off your riot suit," which is, I think I remember from the Pentagon in 1968.
They get recycled. as far as lessons, you drew some lessons from this whole fight over the removal of the Grove of Oaks over at UC Berkeley, too. You write about that as well.
Yeah. It's interesting, complicated at Berkeley because in the middle of the campus, the most popular cafe is called the Free Speech Cafe, and some of Mario Savio's words are emblazoned on the wall, and the newspapers from that time are there for the kids to see. So it's a tough thing to recruit people to a school by glamorizing civil disobedience and then beating them up if they try it out. So I thought the first rule of intelligent leadership in this case would be to try to figure out how to deal with conflict without beating people up. It doesn't seem that complicated to me.
Well, I mentioned your essay on Kant's essay here, and the book, that particular essay particularly, is really a plea for peace. And one wonders, you know, despite Shelley thinking that the poets are the unacknowledged legislators of our civilization, how much can poetry really affect the consciousness, especially the body politic, when it comes to things like war and peace. And I mean, you were very strong and strident in your poetry as well as in your public persona against the war in Iraq, war in Afghanistan. How much impact, really? How much effect did you have, you think?
I have no idea. Somewhere near the nun on the needle, I would guess. But what I say in this essay, I was invited to go to an international literary symposium, and the proposed subject was perpetual peace. And I thought, to quote one of my Potrero Hill aunts, "Lord save us, you know, Mary save us," that it was impossible to talk about that subject. And then I realized that it was a reference to a great essay written by the philosopher Kant in 1795. It's one of the classic short works of the entire Enlightenment, Paul Ryan's favorite period, Kant says, "I wonder if philosophy can do anything about these endless wars," and he begins to make a series of propositions.
This is what I just asked you about poetry.
Yeah, and so anyway, the short answer is there's no control. So we have no way of knowing if the world would have been more violent had there not been a literary imagination. We don't know how much the literary imagination has contributed to that violence, how much the Psalms of David are responsible for encouraging violence against other tribal peoples, how much the Iliad and the Odyssey, by romanticizing war, have contributed to war. We just have no way of knowing. And since we have no way of knowing, I quoted Czesław Miłosz saying to me one time when we were working on a poem of his, "Sometimes it's better to say something. If you don't know, it's at least better not to be silent." But anyway, short answer, who knows? But one has to try.
Well, in the Kant essay, talks about, well, as one would expect of Immanuel Kant, the importance of reason, as if reason can make us somehow more pacific or more peace-bound people. But that seems to have failed, too, when one looks at history.
Yeah, no, it's failed spectacularly, except that Kant made a series of proposals. One of them was he, in effect, invented the Geneva Accords in 1795, that there can be rules governing the brutality of war to limit it. He made the suggestion that has not worked, that Republican government, democratic governments, would be less likely to go to war than princes, because princes love wars and they can't think of anything else to do with themselves, which is George Bush, clearly a case of
too much time on his hands.
And, too much opportunity with too many big weapons in his hands, probably. He also proposed that the power to tax for war be vested in Congress. It's a short essay, and it's really worth reading because he's trying to think out ways to limit, through reasonable procedures, the irrational instinct to drum up a war and to drum up patriotic reasons for kids to go off and get themselves killed.
Some questions to you from listeners, but I want to read first a email from Max, who writes, "Anybody who thinks that minimum force was used at Sproul Plaza or at any other Occupy events needs to get on YouTube and do a little searching. There are dozens, if not scores, of videos of violent police abuse during protests in the East Bay over the past year."
Well, I would like to say that if I said that like the unfortunate congressman in
Don't even make that analogy, yeah, Bob.
I misspoke. They used far less force than I've seen used at other times in other places at Sproul Plaza. Some of the cops seemed to me totally out of deputies seemed to me entirely out of control. Some of them seemed to be genuinely figuring out how to use restraint. I saw brutal things. They began when they were ordered to begin. which I don't think they should have happened, to push people back. They stopped when they were ordered to stop. It wasn't a police riot. That's all I meant.
Liz writes, you mentioned that The Woman Warrior was the most read book in college campuses. I wonder if you would comment on which books you feel are overlooked by college curriculums and should be read more by young people.
Oh, you know, young people are going to find their own way to reading. And I'm partly afraid that once a book becomes the book they're supposed to read, it will get a bad reputation. So I'm not too worried about what books are overlooked in that way. In the curriculum, I think one of the things that happened that's worth commenting on is that it's become more and more urgent for all of us to think about stewardship of the earth and the kind of writing that doesn't get taught in literature courses, that is literature, is natural history writing and science writing.
Can I add something else to that?
I think
you're right on both counts. But also, there's not enough poetry taught. I mean, you have literature students who get through an English major and they've never even been exposed to Robert Haas, Gary Snyder. Mm-hmm. I mean, writers who also can make you think of environmental and ecological issues in a new way and in an important way.
It's interesting, because I teach poetry all the time, it wouldn't have occurred to me that poetry wasn't being taught.
Trust me, it's not. Here's Timothy, who says, my favorite writer and essayist on art, light, and seeing is John Ruskin. Would be curious to know what Mr. Haas has to say about him.
That he's supremely great. I thought, when I heard John, I thought you were going to say John Berger, the 20th century English writer, and I would add his name to that. But Ruskin is the great writer about art.
I said earlier that you start these essays writing about Wallace Stevens, and one thing that Stevens was certainly not known for, except I think maybe the exception Mrs. Burnshaw and the statue, was political elements or anything polemical in his work. He was an aesthete, really, as you said about Eliot. How much of it is a poet's responsibility? I mean, you live a very political life. You live with a wife who is very politically minded. How much is, again, that get it to that unacknowledged legislator, how much is it important for the poet to be a part of that whole process of politicizing?
My first answer to that is always to think about Emily Dickinson, who wrote 300 of the best poems in the English language in the middle of the Civil War that seem mainly to have been motivated by the fact that her sister-in-law hurt her feelings.
Okay.
Robert Duncan.
That's a wonderful response.
Yeah. Robert Duncan said the responsibility of the poet is to respond, so to keep the ability to respond. So I think different poets do it in different ways. Stevens is a very great poet, and his political attitudes, such as they were entirely conventional, and it can be annoying to other poets that his poetry is so wonderful because it's never messy from having to deal with the stuff that poets who are concerned about the history and the world and violence and what's happening to other people are concerned about.
But he was unconventional in more ways than I think many readers of Stevens realize. When you read a poem, I think it's a magnificent poem, always have, like Sunday Morning, you realize that it's advocating a kind of hedonism, paganism, secularism, all of these sorts of things at the time were very unorthodox.
Yeah.
We bring another caller on here, and we go to John in San Francisco wants to talk about the Kant essay. John, go ahead.
Professor Haas, thank you very much for the show. And Professor Haas, a question and a comment. The question is just the specific name of the Kant essay related to war. And then the comment is that listening to you, it's actually quite emotional, but I would say your fierce and gentle manner as a person and your willingness to be an active fair witness of society, I think, is the greatest, I'll say, testament to yourself as a poet and a person. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that call. I mean, your poetry can get people emotional. You know, you're going on talking on the radio, and your ontological self would get that effect. But what's the name of the essay, he wants to know?
There's a funny story about it, which I tell, and that is that, yes, it has to do with war. And Kant got the idea for the essay, he said, because he was in Leiden in Holland, and he saw a tobacconist shop, and the sign outside showed a Dutch burgher in a graveyard leaning against a tombstone smoking a pipe. And underneath it said, "Der ewige Frieden," perpetual peace, borrowed from the Dutch Reform liturgy for the dead, which may he receive perpetual peace. And so Kant begins the essay as a kind of joke, saying the only time there's ever going to be perpetual peace is when we're all dead or smoking a pipe in a cemetery, and then goes on to say, but maybe reason can address the insanity and violence of the world.
We're coming to the end of this hour. How many languages do you know?
One.
Really?
English.
Because you've translated so many different languages. That in itself is a phenomenon.
I've studied other languages a little bit in order to be able to read them, but I'm not fluent in any language but English.
Well, you're fluent in giving us the great gift of your poetry, and it's been, as it always is, a pleasure to have you here, and thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
New collection of essays that Robert Haas has published. It's called What Light Can Do, Essays on Art, Imagination, and the Natural World. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. We always remind you, you can let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our Facebook page, and you are invited to join our Facebook page. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our producers are Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, and Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.